Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Sing, muses. Sing to me a story of Olympus and the deathless gods who govern earth, sea, and sky. So asks the priestess of Tauris. She is an unlikely executioner. Young and beautiful. That's clear even through the veil. But all Orestes can focus on is the knife glinting in her hand. He came to Tauris to fulfill a sacred charge. Steal the statue of Artemis from her temple. The gods have promised him that it is the final task of his atonement, that it will bring to a close the cycle of king-killing that has plagued his family. Orestes, who killed his mother, Clytemnestra. Clytemnestra, who killed her husband, Agamemnon. But Orestes made it no further than the Taurian coast. A fisherman spied his boat and brought the city guards. You see, the laws of Tauris are simple. Any Greek who trespasses the shores must die. And so Orestes has been brought before the priestess, bound and tied. She is to prepare him, to anoint and purify him, and finally, to lead him out to sacrifice. But something gives her pause. She stands before him, meets his gaze, those eyes green, flecked with gold, like tarnished copper. This is the first time a prince's blood will stain our temple steps. Orestes' surprise is unmistakable. It's your eyes, the priestess explains. They're just like your sister's, Iphigenia. How could you know that? Orestes replies. My sister died when she was little more than a child. Artemis demanded it in revenge. The priestess laughs then. A sudden, sharp thing that cuts like no bronze ever could. Ignorance does not become a prince. Let the muses tell you. Let them tell you of Artemis's true revenge.
It's The Ancients on History Hit. I'm Tristan Hughes, your host. And in today's episode, where we are continuing our Greek gods and goddesses mini-series. Today, it's the turn of Artemis, goddess of the hunt. Now, to kick off this episode, as we do with all of our Greek gods and goddesses episodes, we're beginning it with a story, a retelling of a myth closely associated with Artemis. And the myth we've chosen is the story of Iphigenia, princess of Mycenae, and the daughter of King Agamemnon, leader of the Greek forces in the Trojan War. Now, Iphigenia's story is a tragic one. It's a tale where the Greek leaders, including her dad, Agamemnon, decided to sacrifice her to Artemis to appease this deity. Following this retelling, we have an interview with the very engaging and straight-talking classicist Jasmine Elmer to explore more of Artemis's very complex story. She is so much more than just the goddess of the hunt. I really do hope you enjoy. Here's the myth retelling and then here's Jasmine to talk all things Artemis.
The Muses start their song with the snapping of canvas and the creaking of bowlines. There are so many ships moored in the Euripus Strait that you could walk from Aulis on one side to Bishir on the other via their decks and gangways. So many painted sails that the horizon is all but lost in a riot of colour. It is the greatest armada the world has ever seen. And it is trapped. A savage wind blows from the east, from the direction of Troy, and all the kings of Greece know it for a sign. One of the gods does not favour their conquest. A swarm of prophets, soothsayers and oracles descend then upon Aulis. The Aruspices make an offering of 100 goats, sheep and heifers, consulting entrails for some diagnosis of divine displeasure. The scapulomancers dig through sacrificial offcuts of shoulder bones with ominous abnormalities. The cartomancers cut cards. The cleromancers throw dice. The pyromancers light 100 fires on the beach. And by their light, the numerologists scribble a century of proofs in the sand. Finally, Calchas the augur comes before Agamemnon, king of kings. While taking a census of the gulls, I spied a buzzard, watching, not stalking. It was Artemis, the huntress. It is she who keeps this fleet trapped. Agamemnon looks up in dread, then at the pair of gilded antlers that decorate the temporary throne room on his ship. Artemis's disfavor is not with the Greek conquest. It is with him. Words may be winged, but they cannot be caged. Soon all the kings know Agamemnon's folly. He has killed Artemis's sacred deer while hunting in the hills of Aulis. And now, Calchas, the augur, insists there is only one recourse, one way the armada will ever set sail. The king of kings must kill something equally dear to him. He must sacrifice one of his children. Does Agamemnon do so willingly? Even the Muses cannot agree on that. It happens sometimes, a discord slipping into their song. Truth may be singular to a deathless god, but not to a human. Mortal minds always hold truths that are multiple, conflicting, cacophonous. And so one of the Muses' melodies contends Agamemnon cared nothing for any of his children, only ever for Troy. Another vows he loved them all deeply, that he refused and raged and raved until he saw the threat of mutiny in the other king's eyes. And a third insists it was a different fear altogether that guided him. What if by dallying, by arguing, he worsened Artemis's punishment? What if she demanded a specific child? What if she came for his son, Orestes? Eventually, the Muses' song does reach harmony, though. For there is no denying a child is summoned to Aulis. One of Agamemnon's daughters, Iphigenia. She believes she comes to marry swift-footed Achilles, the best of the Greeks. And as the procession leads her down to the beach, her heart soars. Then it stops. There is no bridegroom. There is no feast. There is Calchas, and there is a pyre. Her screams are enough to split the sky, enough to put every bird in Aulis to flight. Every bird, except one lone buzzard. Artemis watches the scene on the beach with confusion. Yes, she sought to punish Agamemnon. The deer was sacred to her. But so too are young women, virgin girls brought to marriage. She will have her revenge on Agamemnon and the Greeks, but not like this. She stretches gilded talons, she unfurls great golden wings, and she explodes into the sky like a spark from the anvil. Down on the beach, Iphigenia begins to feel the lick of the flames when something descends, draping her in a feathered cloak. It is a moment of calm in the heart of the inferno. A single, smokeless breath. And then comes the lightness, her limbs shedding their weight till she is little more than a feather herself, caught in the pyre's updraft. When she finally looks down, she can see them. Soldiers, kings, Calchas, her father. Cowards all. They have turned away in the final moments, and so none of them notice her flight. Then the beach slips away, and she is gliding over wooden hulls and canvas sails, the greatest armada the world has ever seen. And then the ships slip away too, and there is nothing. Nothing but the endless, wine-dark sea. It was a long way Artemis carried that young girl, the priestess says, waving her knife as if conducting the muse's song to a close. Across the Aegean, all the way to this temple in Tauris, Artemis brings her. There, the goddess gives her a sacred charge. Any Greek who trespasses Tauris's shores must die. And Iphigenia, that girl who every Greek stood back and watched die, she carries it out willingly, gladly, because she is Artemis's true revenge. And now the gods send to Iphigenia you, her father's son, her father's favorite. And as she speaks, the priestess edges closer and closer, bringing the knife closer and closer till Orestes can see a reflection in the polished blade. Eyes green, flecked with gold, like tarnished copper. But it is not his reflection. It is the priestess. It is Iphigenia. "We always were a family of king killers," she whispers, and the knife trembles at Orestes' throat.
Jasmine, it is such a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Welcome to the show.
I'm so excited to be here. I mean, obviously, this is the Ancients podcast. I mean, where else should I be, really? Should always be here.
Well, exactly. And well, I'll hold you to that so you can come back in the future too. We were talking about doing this episode together months ago, almost a year ago when we were at a book launch. I think it was Michael Scott, wasn't it? And now we're finally here talking about Artemis. Jasmine, first off, no such thing as a silly question. Who was Artemis?
I love that. Well, Artemis is obviously one of the Greek goddesses, of the main Olympian goddesses. And she is goddess of many, many things. Obviously, we'll get into this in a moment. But most notably, hunting, wild animals, chastity, and, you know, that kind of like domain. You know, she's actually quite a lot of things. And I feel like sometimes we'll think of virginity. I don't know if that's the word you were hoping that I would say, but most people go, goddess of virginity. But let's hold off on that. But in fact, she's goddess of so many different things.
So many different things. And it seems to be of all of these deities, we think of them, we associate them with one thing like Ares' war, Poseidon, the sea. But there's always so much more to their story, which I love. But one thing I'd like to ask first of all, before we kind of go into her origins, is when we see depictions of Artemis on statues and pottery and so on, I mean, how is she usually portrayed?
Yeah, so she's usually portrayed as a young maiden, so a young woman, often in some kind of hunting scene. So therefore, you often see her associated with bows, spears, any hunting weaponry like that. She can have like a deerskin cape sometimes to sort of connect her to the wild, an animal pelt cap. It's that kind of thing. Sometimes there's wild animals around her, like a deer or something like that. But very much situated as a young woman in the wilderness often is her main kind of motif.
And alongside animals, is she, because I got it in my notes here, is she sometimes surrounded by things like nymphs, these other kind of mythical creatures?
Yeah, and there are a couple of traditions where she was maybe the first nymph, not necessarily Olympian goddess, but the first nymph. But she is associated with nymphs, which makes sense because nymphs are essentially little goddesses that relate to natural places. So because she is in the wild, she's surrounded by the nymphs that personify springs and trees and other such things, mountains. So sometimes we see her with those young women too.
Fair enough. Well, let's delve into her origin story. I love the origin stories of these figures. What is the story about how Artemis comes to be?
So Artemis is a twin. So she is born with her twin god, Apollo. And I know we'll probably want to chat about that later on. And her mother is Leto and her father is Zeus. So it's quite an interesting kind of story already, because we all know about Zeus and how many lovers he takes. So, you know, these twins come together as a package. I think that's the first thing that I really want to make a point of, because their story is really important as they kind of evolve together as gods.
So, Jasmine, it's quite funny, isn't it? Zeus, he has all of these lovers, and so many deities kind of come about because of these love interests and other mythical creatures. Seems like Leto is quite similar. And then ultimately you get Apollo and Artemis, these twins. Now, with Artemis, do we know much about her relationship first with her mother, Leto, and then with her twin brother, Apollo?
Yeah, both relationships, I think, are quite pivotal and give us an idea, I think, about why we associate Artemis with certain things. So Leto has a strong connection with childbirth. And one of the things that people get puzzled about all the time is, if Artemis is a virginity goddess, which is, I really want to get into that word later, but why is she associated with childbirth? Because she is midwifery in childbirth. And possible answer to that is actually this connection with Leto and through her mother. And there is a famous story that when, as a twin, she was the firstborn in some traditions and actually helped birth her brother. So actually stood there with, which is not thought, right, as this newborn baby, helping get her brother out. And it might be that's where this connection to childbirth comes from, midwifery, through the mother and through that particular first role. And then, of course, you have her twin brother, Apollo. And we see so many kind of, I guess, contrasts between these two gods as they grow up. So famously, they're both very obsessed with archery. And there's a rivalry, a sibling rivalry. I myself am an only child, but if you've got siblings, you'll know exactly what I'm chatting about. It's this competition between the two to who can be the best archer and kind of how, and I guess the domains in which they do that are quite different. But, you know, they definitely have this rivalry. And there's, you know, famously, Apollo is connected to the sun. And, you know, there are some traditions where Artemis is connected to the moon. And I know that's an interesting point to discuss as well, perhaps in a moment. So I think from the very outset, these relationships in some way forge our understanding and the kind of characteristics of Artemis in the early stories.
Well, I was going to ask that question about the moon and the sun a bit later, but as you've kind of hinted at it now, let's just explore it now. Because, so you say, cool. Apollo becomes god of the sun and Artemis, goddess of the hunt and so much more. In that so much more, why does she become associated with the moon? It's almost like the opposite of the sun.
Yes, exactly. So I think the association with Apollo and the sun is kind of there pretty early on, and light in general. And there are different, like, kind of, I guess, ideas about where this connection to the moon, because it's not necessarily there from the very outset. There are inklings of it, but it's not a very strong association. But one association could be to do with the fact that as Artemis is connected to things like childbirth and midwifery, then it makes sense that it might move to the menstrual cycle, and then the menstrual cycle is linked to the moon. So it could be that she gets kind of conflated into that notion of like fertility in that particular way. Again, that feels weird, right? Because we keep talking about this idea of virginity, but this aspect of her character. So that's the first thing perhaps to say about it. And there's also some tradition in that Plutarch says that she was the goddess that brought the full moon for the Battle of Salamis. So it could be that it was like a tradition that arrived, because really you see this real connection with the moon, particularly into the Roman period when Artemis becomes Diana, and this connection with the moon gets stronger and stronger, because we really think of Diana as associated with the moon. So it's a bit of a later / Roman thing rather than a Greek thing. But just to be clear, it is sort of there in inklings in the Greek tradition as well.
Really nice to highlight that straight away. And as we kind of go and explore these kind of different aspects of how she's worshipped, what she represents. I mean, I must also ask quickly, this is a slight tangent, Jasmine, but if we know stuff about her relationship with her mother, Leto, and of course with her twin brother, Apollo, do we know much from the myths, from the story of Artemis, about her relationship with her dad, with Zeus?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are obviously aspects of this that go on, but in the same, I shouldn't say this to you. I mean, Zeus isn't really listening, so I could say this. He's a bit of a hands-off daddy, isn't he, at times? He sort of goes round a bit. A deadbeat dad, I think they call him. So in terms of, like, it's more of his role, off he goes, getting all these kids out into the world and then just disappears. So, of course, there are associations. I can think of perhaps some reasonably generic, but examples perhaps where she will appeal to Zeus, and Zeus will be like, oh, okay, cool, we'll help you out there. nothing massive is popping up into my mind. But of course, I think that like all of Zeus's children, sometimes in myth, they will just go, Dad, help me out. Something's happened. And then he will. But I don't, it's not really a big part of her story, really. I think it's very much, and although we've spoken about Leto and Apollo, you know, that's a part of her origin story. I wouldn't say that that's a dominating factor. In fact, I kind of want to get away from the idea that we should look at Artemis in like always in association with Apollo, because we need to look at her in her own right as well. So I think of that as an origin thing rather than a all the time Leto and Apollo are knocking around in the background and, you know, giving her orders on what to do or changing the course of her stories.
Absolutely fair enough. Also, I love that idea of Zeus's the hands-off dad. That's great. I've never heard that one
deadbeat
before.
Deadbeat dad. He is, isn't he?
Absolutely. You're quite right. Okay, well, let's explore Artemis the figure and all the things that she's associated with. I mean, first of all, as goddess of the hunt. Now, once again, no such thing as a silly question. We have in our minds what a hunt is today, but what was a hunt in ancient Greek times?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, again, that's a lovely broad question there, Tristan, because it would have changed, obviously, over time. And I think it's really important to get real with it, first of all, and understand that hunting in very early cultures is a necessity. So what was it in early, very early Greek society? It was, I need food, I am going to get it. And, you know, that's the first thing to say. So people needed to go and hunt wild animals to live. So what I think you're getting at, and the thing that people are more interested in, is how does that become, if you like, a pastime or a more ritualistic thing that occurs and then under the domain of someone like Artemis? So I think that you can connect that closely to the male elites of any Greek society. So from the thing where I need to go out and get some food, you get this concept of let's make hunting some kind of sporting event, some kind of elite event where men who are in higher up in echelons of Greek society would come together and they would go out on a hunt as a kind of a masculinity element, you know, kind of going out as a masculine thing. And of course, as part of that, there are rituals and there's a religious connotation with Artemis as well. But I think it's important to that. Of course, it's not to say there aren't female hunters. And of course, we've got examples in mythology of that. But I think in terms of what's going on in Greek society, it's a male dominated space. Interestingly, though, overseen by a young woman in the form of Artemis.
I mean, exactly. So as Artemis is the goddess of the hunt, I mean, what does that involve? I mean, how do these young elite men pay their respects to this deity as they go on these hunts and so on?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think that's a little bit broad as well, because obviously I think that like religion today, I think all aspects are kind of can be personal. So that you can't always know exactly what's going on. But traditional things that people would do, obviously there might be prayers or offerings to the goddess before a hunt, purification. So one of the really interesting things is hunters would abstain from having sex before they went on a hunt. I mean, this is reasonably gross. So you probably don't want to get into this too much. But the reason was apparently that purification meant there were no scents on their body. And obviously that might be that connection with virginity or that chastity element that comes into Artemis. So we can think sometimes about the connections between the men that are kind of hunting and Artemis to be a little bit more kind of fluid, I think, than what we're thinking them as being. So that might be where that connection to virginity comes in or chastity. But yeah, so you know, talking about prayers, you're talking about rituals. Obviously there are places to go and worship Artemis. Possibly, though, they're more female spaces than they would be male spaces. And I'm generalising again there, but I think that her wider worship was quite attractive to women. And that's because of that young maiden element. We can obviously talk about that in a moment, but that element of it was probably very strong. And of course, there are other like deities that relate to the wild that the hunters might connect to, like Pan or someone like that as well. So I think that's where we get this. I don't call it pick and mix religion because that sounds a bit strange, but in some ways that is kind of what's going on. So we might get, you know, kind of a few different deities being called upon to honour the hunt and assist with it.
Because it is so interesting. And I like that being, you know, ritual purification is absolutely important to highlight, as you mentioned, like, you know, not going out after having sex or you have to clean yourself. Because, I mean, that is something that you see time and time again in ancient societies, this kind of distancing sex and doing rituals and stuff. So once again, you can see why that is there. I mean, what I also find quite interesting as an outsider, as a Joe Bloggs looking into this, I don't know too much about this, is how, yes, Artemis seems to be associated as a hunter, but at the same time, you know, she's goddess of the wilderness, of wild animals. So it's almost like she's rooting for both sides in the hunt in a kind of way.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I actually never thought about it like that. It's obviously really obvious, actually, when you think of it. But yeah, I think that is, and that's where I like to get into the, oh, I can really introduce the point I want to make about Artemis in a wider sense, which is she's really complex. And that's one of the things about her that I love, because so easy to just relegate her to this, oh, this wild goddess, see you later sort of thing. And that's all she is. But that there's a complexity even in that. How can you be a preserver of nature and a lover of wild animals and then encourage others to hunt? And I think that that is just I haven't got a nice answer for you about that. I think this is one of those complexities, paradoxes about that you get with gods. You just get things when you're like, what is that about? Well, how can you be that and that? But I think that's because people are that and that. Because gods essentially, although they're gods, they do reflect human nature. You know, so having these contrasts, I think, is probably really quite expected. I'm sure when you talk about other gods, you see these contrasts and go, oh, another one. But I mean, really, anything that goes on in the wild spaces is her thing. So it's all aspects of those wild spaces, I would imagine, that she is connected to.
Hmm. And also another quick tangent before we kind of go on to this thing that I know you really want to talk about, which is virginity and this idea of Artemis as a virgin goddess, is you mentioned earlier kind of like places where she's worshipped. And I'm imagining, you know, your classic Greek temples. But because she's so associated with the wild and the wilderness, should we also be imagining things like sacred groves or places out in nature for the worship of Artemis?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, harder to pinpoint archaeologically, you know, to know that those things are going on. But there's enough evidence from various sources that type of worship would have gone on. And it just also makes logical sense, which is sometimes how I quite like to approach these things. But you're right, absolutely, there will have been worship going on more privately, more personally, in those sorts of spaces, like you say, in groves. And the mountainous regions are very much connected to Artemis. You know, in lots of mythological traditions, it's the mountain that she's roaming on. It's always a mountain. So, you know, those sorts of spots, absolutely. And then, of course, you've got, you know, those temple complexes. And actually, there's a lot of evidence for very widespread worship of Artemis across the Mediterranean, which is another thing that people don't really know about her or think about her, that she actually was kind of a great unifier as a goddess, because she actually, you know, because we see this evidence of her worship across the Mediterranean in various forms. So not just this minor goddess that's part of a bigger pantheon of often sometimes more male gods, but actually really quite powerful and well-respected across the Mediterranean world.
That's very interesting. And I think there's certainly a name of Ephesus, which we'll get to in time, which is super, super, super interesting.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
How did Hitler's sexuality shape his worldview? Why did the Black Death lead to the rise of the witch trials? And what are some of the sauciest scandals involving kings and queens at Hampton Court? I don't know about you, but this is the history I want to hear about. If you do too, then join me, Kate Lister, every Tuesday and Friday to find out the answers to all of these questions and more. Listen to Betwixt the Sheets, the history of sex scandal in society, wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
Let's first explore this whole idea of Artemis as the virgin goddess. I mean, Jasmine, there feels like there's a lot to unpack with this part of Artemis's story.
Yeah, there is. I think that it's a bit of my mission, and certainly when I've written about Artemis in my book, I think it's very easy, and again, I'm going to use the swear word, patriarchy. I think it's been easy with a more patriarchal view of gods and goddesses that has amassed over time, which thankfully is absolutely reversing nowadays. But, you know, I think wanting to just relegate her to this thing that's virginal, chaste, is really to do her a massive disservice, because she's also incredibly kind of vengeful and dark and has all these other sides. So it's not that I mind that we connect her to chastity, because it's true, she has those connections and associations. It's more that I think that then we kind of like demote her from a very powerful goddess, a vengeful goddess. And we see so much of that in the mythical tradition about her vengeful side and her dark side. And I think that when we first go to the virgin goddess, which is how some people will refer to her kind of off the bat, I think we just start to miss out on all the nuance and kind of murkiness of her character, which is, for me, far more fascinating than just, oh, okay, this connection to chastity, which we've already sort of looked at.
We will get into that darker side. And it's really interesting because Demeter is very similar, that kind of vengeful Demeter after the abduction of her daughter, Persephone. And I found that fascinating. But I mean, yes, we have kind of mentioned it earlier, but just to kind of clarify for the followers of Artemis, Jasmine, back in ancient Greek times, this whole idea, as you know, this chaste young goddess and association with childbirth as well, should we still, though, imagine that this was very important for those who would have gone and worshipped Artemis? I don't want to just kind of throw it out completely.
No. I didn't mean to say that. What I'm trying to do is spotlight an area that I think that we don't focus on, rather than I'm not trying to suggest that the rest of it's useless. You're completely right. For her followers, the primary thing really probably is a protectress of young girls and young maidens. Because, you know, essentially when you are, before you're married and you're a young woman, you are essentially under the protection of Artemis, and you transfer into the protection of the more matronly goddesses once you're married. So yeah, of course, that's so important. And there are loads of ritualistic and festivals that relate to that one element. So don't get me wrong, that is important. But it's just, I think, also to understand that because of the way that perhaps more patriarchal views have kind of perpetrated over the years, you get the notion then that there's no power in that somehow. And I think it's just important to understand that her stories, these young women that know her stories, know that she's got that side to her. And that's kind of fascinating as well. So that's all I mean by that. So you're right, let's not mislead any of your listeners to think, all right, well, then there's nothing to do with it. Of course, plenty to do with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've explained it so well so far, Jasmine. And it's kind of, we're now absolutely setting up perfectly that other part of Artemis's story. Let's talk about Artemis and divine retribution, because this is certainly a goddess that you don't want to cross. You get your comeuppance if you come, well, if you get on the bad side of Artemis, don't you?
Oh, for sure. Exactly. I mean, I know this is, again, those people that are big into their mythology know that this happens with goddesses. This is not like, she's not like, think about Hera and, you know, like kind of the vengefulness of that goddess. So it's not that it's specific to her, but I think like it's particularly brutal stuff. And I kind of love that. I'm not like a sadist, but I just think it's a fascinating aspect of her character, especially for a young woman, as we're saying. So, I mean, multiple myths. So many, I think, you know, tens and tens of myths that relate to her divine retribution.
Should we focus on, I mean, should we do the story of Actaeon? Because this is the one that I've heard of the name Actaeon the Hunter, and this is quite a classic. And it's, I mean, poor old Actaeon, but he kind of got it, he got what was coming for him. Let's tell us the story of Actaeon, Jasmine.
Well, I'm glad you picked that one, actually, because that's the one I've done the retelling of in my book. So nice job. And we didn't actually set that up, so I appreciate that. But yeah, so Actaeon is a hunter, probably previous to this episode, reasonably beloved by Artemis for being a hunter. And he's out and about, in the forest, and notices Artemis bathing in a pool with her nymphs, obviously unclothed. You can imagine that as a woman that guards her chastity and holds that very high, doesn't like that very much. So poor old Actaeon gets turned into a stag by Artemis. And that's not the bit. No, that's the, that, okay, that's fine. But the cool bit or brutal bit. I'm making my son sound like a real nutter here, aren't I, basically? But the cool bit is his own hunting dogs then turn on him and rip him apart as a stag. I mean, if you ever want a story about the dangers of the male gaze on a woman, I mean, that's the one. I don't know if any man would ever look up again at a woman thinking about that particular story. But that's just, again, I mean, this is, again, a lot of interpretations of that are, oh, she's so obsessed with her virginity that she's so brutal. But I would say that she owns and guards her own sexuality. And this is a punishment for someone trying to take any of that power away from her, rather than like, oh, that I know that there's a lot of, especially, you know, Renaissance, kind of later ideas about this kind of very demure woman, like trying to cover herself up. And it's kind of like she feels vulnerable. But I think in lots of ways, actually, the vengeance shows actually it's like, that's my power. Don't you take that away from me. And has, you know, kind of shown you the kind of violence in her divine, as you said, her retribution for that crime as she sees it.
I mean, Actaeon was a peeping Tom. He could have walked away. He didn't. And, you know.
Yes, of course.
He got what was coming for him.
He did just stand there, according to most traditions. He didn't just sort of try and run off. So, yeah, fair enough. Maybe it's comeuppance. I mean, we'll leave that to your listeners to work out what they think.
Exactly. I know that this interview, as with all our interviews in the Greek Gods and Goddesses interviews, is preceded by a retelling of a myth associated with the goddess or goddess. And this one, it's not the story of Actaeon, although I kind of wish now it was, because that is brutal, but absolutely also so cool. But it is actually another story related to the Trojan War. Now, to kind of set the scene for us, Jasmine, so many deities take part in the Trojan War. They take one side or the other. How does Artemis fit into the Trojan War? I mean, what side does she take and how involved is she?
Yeah, so she, uncharacteristically maybe, goes on the same side as her brother. So they both are supporters of Troy. So, you know, in terms of her involvement, there are multiple little examples of where she is involved in the war. Like there are a few healings and things like that. But most famously is the story probably of Iphigenia.
Yes. So let's explore.
Which is possibly what you...
Yeah. You absolutely know me right, Jasmine. So let's explore. What is the story of Iphigenia?
Yeah, well, very tragic story, really. So we have the Greeks are trying to, you know, come over and attack Troy, and they're becalmed. So Artemis makes the sea unsailable for them. And a prophet tells Agamemnon, who is the leader of the Greek troops, that he can't sail unless he sacrifices his daughter to Artemis to calm her down and give favourable seas. And so he does this. He offers up Iphigenia as a sacrifice to Artemis. And there are various interpretations of her willingness to do that. But seemingly she's willing to give herself up to Artemis as a sacrifice. And in fact, there are rituals that young girls followed at a festival, the Boronia, where they would imitate this slightly as well. This connection to that, was giving themselves up for sacrifice as well. So brutal. But another one where Artemis is using her divine retribution, really, and powers to meddle in the lives of mortals.
This was quite interesting that she's associated with the sea there, because we've talked about the moon, we talked about the hunt, we talked about the wilderness and virginity. But in this case, she's also associated with the sea. Is this a one-off, or is this also something we also see associated with her? Or the winds, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, yes, the winds, absolutely right. It's the winds that are whipping up. The sea's obviously really Poseidon's domain. I mean, most of the time, it's weathers that cause bad seas anyway, isn't it, rather than coming from underneath. I think there is this inherent nature in Artemis as being something quite wild.
Let's kind of go into the legacy and the kind of depictions, the importance of Artemis to Greek societies, both in ancient times and for people more generally in more recent history. How has she been depicted? Let's start with art. How is she depicted usually in art in ancient Greek history? And I know, once again, it's a broad question, so it probably changes over time. But that's another great part of Artemis' story, is that she is so complex. So depictions of Artemis, they must vary in different forms.
Yeah, they do. I mean, like I said, the most common motif is this connection that we spoke about at the beginning, which is this in some kind of wilderness. So anything that relates to her with wilderness. What I love about her as well is she can wear short skirts, which, as we know, most Greek women would not wear short skirts. This was something that Spartan women would, but, you know, most women didn't. They covered their legs. But she was allowed short skirts and was portrayed as such, which is a reasonably big deal to a Greek viewer, because obviously we don't see that very often in their everyday lives. But what I love about her is you often get her in action. So I know that many artists try to show gods in action, but because she is absolutely always hunting, moving, doing something, you get these short skirts, which denote essentially some sporting activity, and then this movement with her. And I like that often there's interaction with wild animals. Like I said, you're a deer or something like that that associated with her. But you are right that there are times when that is downplayed slightly, perhaps when we're trying to get out a little bit more about her connection to perhaps childbirth or midwifery or those contexts. So you do find her in those different spheres. And obviously, I know you're talking about the Greek image of her, but of course, when we get out into the Renaissance, that changes somewhat. I think in Greek art, there is an element of agency and power with Artemis often. She's not relegated to like a tiny space or anything like that. But I think when we get to Renaissance, there's much more interest in that kind of chase. I mean, this is the thing that they do with all of them, right? This is not like a Artemis specific, but an interesting kind of her being quite demure and not as vengeful and kind of, you know, less powerful, I think.
Let's talk about building, because what is this relationship that Artemis has with one of the, well, according to the Greek list, the official seven wonders of the ancient world?
Yeah, so there is the famous Temple of Artemis at Ephesus, which sadly is now essentially a tiny bit of rubble.
One column surviving, isn't it?
Which is really disappointing to people that go to see this wonderful ancient wonder and then go, oh. But it would have been an absolutely huge complex. I mean, like all these things, there's this huge temple that would have been there. I mean, it went through various stages of destruction and rebuild, as they often do when there's a site that is inhabited and used for a long time. So it goes through various iterations, but it really is an absolutely huge complex. And again, more than just a temple, this is obviously a place of sanctuary for the goddess. So like with many sites, you get more than just a temple. You've got kind of, you know, various other types of buildings that relate to that. I mean, I'm being general because there are so many different types of things. You know, you can get theatres, you can get bar complex, you can get all sorts of things that go alongside the kind of essentially situating it as a main site for Artemis. But what I think is really interesting about this is that obviously this is in Turkey. So we're talking about, I guess, the border between the Greek world and then the ancient Near East. And so the people at Ephesus do kind of have their own type of Artemis there, their own specific, I don't know if this is something you want to get into now, but...
Yes, absolutely. This is extraordinary. Yeah.
Yes. This is their own sort of version. I mean, there are many, like with all goddesses, there are many epithets and types of Artemis that exist, like many, many, probably thousands in the end, but definitely hundreds that happen all over the Greek world. So if you don't know, you know, you have these goddesses or gods, or they have these epithets, which are like elements of their character that a particular place wants to worship or take out of that god or goddess. So that happens all over the place. But here at Ephesus, we kind of get like a little bit of a melding of the Greek Artemis with like Near Eastern gods and goddesses. Sorry, not gods, goddesses. And actually, her iconography is quite interesting because there is more of an interest then in her. She looks more sexual, I'm just going to be honest about it. There's possibility of having quite large breasts and like rounded shape and curves that is much more, I think, common in Near Eastern iconography, less in the Greek. So they kind of create their own type of very distinctive Artemis at Ephesus.
Yeah, she's more kind of like a mother goddess. It's like Kybele, isn't it, or one of those goddesses that's mixed?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. And it's really interesting.
I mean, again, as we know, these ancient cultures do tend to try like to assimilate or connect their own goddesses to ones in other cultures. So yes, there is absolutely that connection. And I think that people are very quick to label something a mother goddess as soon as they see any kind of chest, any kind of female chest. They're like, that must be maternal, motherly. I think that I understand that. And I'm not saying that's not true. Of course, there's definitely a good interpretation, but again, I don't want to denigrate her down to just that because we don't know what that worship was exactly like.
Exactly. And I think there's a credible theory that they're not breasts, that they might be beehives instead, which is very, very interesting. I remember doing an interview about that a long time ago.
You don't want one of them stuck to you.
Well, exactly. No, you definitely do not want that. I mean, well, Jasmine, this has been great so far. I haven't got too much time left. But I mean, I'd like to talk a bit about legacy past ancient Greece. Obviously, she's so significant to all these different Greek city-states and peoples who lived beyond the Greek mainland, as I said, Turkey, but Western Mediterranean, I'm sure, further afield too in the Hellenistic times. When we do get to the Romans, and you mentioned Diana earlier, I mean, How much do they embrace the figure of Artemis when they kind of create the figure of Diana?
Yeah, great question. Again, love your big questions. You asked the big ones, don't you? I mean, Diana, absolutely. I think what I like about Diana is that perhaps because the Romans are so even more obsessed with things like hunting, I think they even almost in some ways raise her up even more as a goddess in terms of her power. I think that in lots of ways that becomes much more of what she's associated with in the Roman period rather than the elements that are more to do with childbirth and midwifery. And of course, there is this element that there's still the young maids. It all continues. But I just feel like the Romans, they almost have like a little shuffle up. And I think that they put to the top this notion more of her as a huntress and this kind of stronger figure. And of course, you get, again, this continued iconography with the wild continues. And I think that Romans, you know, you think about the Roman sculptures, you always nearly always think of a goddess with something stuck to them, which we know is like a more practical way of making satchels. But, you know, there's often the animals around her. And yeah, I think that she becomes a little bit more powerful, I would say. I mean, I don't know if you've got a view about Diana, but I think she's definitely more of a huntress, I think, in the Roman way of thinking than anything else, even though those facets still exist.
I'm not educated enough on the manor to really have a really significant view on this. Apart from that, it kind of makes me feel of the Amazons and stuff like that. And like kind of a halfway house is someone like Kanane, who's the half-sister of Alexander the Great, who's called this Macedonian Amazon. But I think she also very much represents Artemis as this young maiden with a bow and arrow and so on and so forth, and a horse and all that kind of stuff, and hunting, which is just really, really interesting, that kind of alignment when they get Hellenistic culture with elite women who are different to others, and then of course the Romans too. But I digress a bit. That's just my
I can see you're into that. You're really into that. You could probably do another hour on that, couldn't you?
No, maybe not another hour, but I could do half an hour maybe. Last thing I would ask is, if we kind of go down to modern day, I mean, we have seen in, I think, Star Trek, they have references to Medusa and stuff like that, and in other sci-fi shows and, you know, shows today, they have depictions of Greek gods and goddesses. I mean, are there references, I mean, interpretations of Artemis's character?
I think that in recent years, there's been more of an interest in her as a powerful figure, a reclaiming of her as a powerful figure. I think she is really, she speaks a lot to younger women. I think about how to be powerful. And there's a reclaiming on that level. I absolutely think that. I mean, in terms of like, I can't think of anything specific in terms of like popular imagination. Like there hasn't been a Hollywood movie yet about Artemis, which I think they should do. But I think really what a lot of, it's not just, I would say not just kind of in the popular imagination, but also in like scholarly work, that I think there isn't a more of an interest in all of these goddesses, but specifically as well as someone like Artemis, about let's have another look at her and let's see what we've missed. And when we do that, we start to see how utterly complex she is and how many aspects of herself there are. And I think that a lot of young women are finding that particularly powerful in accepting aspects of themselves, which is certainly what my book is about as well. So I think she's about to have a bit of a comeback, really. That's my thing. I think that she's going to, I mean, I think that, you as you know, you know, Greek myth, retellings and things like that in terms of literature and documentaries and things like that, it's very powerful and important. So I think she's going to kind of pop up a bit more is what my crystal ball interpretation of what might happen.
That's what the hunch is. Well, Jasmine, this has been amazing. You hinted at it right there. You do have a book coming up, which includes the story and, you know, reception of Artemis. And this book is all about?
Well, so my book's called Goddess with a Thousand Faces, and it's a mixture of mythical retelling and history, all based on source material. And I see 10 world goddesses. You learn their stories. Some you'll recognise, some you really won't. And Artemis is one of them. Artemis is chapter 2. So you get to read her story and learn a little bit more about Greek society and her, and all the things that we've spoken about. And it's out on pre-order now, so you can find it somewhere in your show notes or on my Instagram if you fancy heading over there.
On the show notes, indeed. Get that book pre-ordered now. Well, Jasmine, it just goes to me to say thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast today.
Thanks so much for having me. A great time.
Well, there you go. There was Jasmine Elmer talking through the story of Artemis, the goddess of the hunt, but also the moon of childbirth, of chastity, the virgin goddess, but also this more vengeful,
this more ferocious side of Artemis too. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Now, the script for the myth retelling was done by Andrew Hulse. The narration was by Nicola Woolley. The assistant producer for the episode was Joseph Knight. The producer was Elena Guthrie. And the episode was all mixed together by Aidan Lonergan. Thank you to you all for making this episode a reality. We're very near the end of our Greek Gods and Goddesses series. Now, we've only got a couple more to do. There's Apollo, there's Dionysus, and then we might do a couple extras at the end. Names such as Heracles come to mind. But in the meantime, if you have been enjoying the Ancients podcast and you want to help us out, well, you know what you can do. You can leave us a lovely rating on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, wherever you get your podcast from. That really helps us as we continue our everlasting mission to grow this podcast and to share these amazing stories from our distant past with you and with as many people as possible. And wherever you're listening to The Ancients, whether that be on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or elsewhere, make sure that you click the follow button, that you are subscribed, so that you don't miss out when we release new episodes twice every week. But that's enough from me, and I will see you in the next episode.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Ancients. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us, and you'll be doing us a big favor. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code ANCIENTS at checkout.